profusely. Would you please tell him to let me go? And that would be because you are the number two agent unseen from the ATF? He glanced at Henry and then back at me. I have no idea what you're talking about. Look, Post is dead, and your AIC, John Stainbrook, or Ray Swift, whichever one he's going by today, is also unseen, so if you want to spend the rest of the afternoon tied to a chair, how did you know it was me? You were always around. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would voluntarily spend time with Eddie the Viking. I looked toward the back door. Where's Nance? Not here. Yep, we got that much. Does he have Lola with him? The backer chick, yeah. He shifted in the seat, but then remembered that he was tied. He said something about taking her to his house for something special. I glanced at the Cheyenne Nation, but his face remained neutral. Special, huh? That's what he said. His eyes darted between us. Look, I don't think he has any idea you people are here. He was going to take her to his place and be back in an hour. Was he armed? He's always armed. Right. I stood and started back toward the MRAP. Well, let's go to the golf course. Aren't you going to untie me? I paused, holstered my Colt, and threw a thumb at the bear. Ask him, Agent Fresco. He's the one who tied you up. Getting the Pequod disentangled from the bunker wreckage and backed over the two vehicles I'd crushed was surprisingly easy. I smiled at Henry as the giant, run-flat tires thumped back onto solid ground. You know, I'm starting to think I do need one of these. Henry rose up and peered through the cracks in the bulletproof glass. It would take up your entire parking lot. I wheeled the Pequod around to the lee side and started back with the gate. It'd be great for rodeo parades. I drove through, turned right, and headed up the hill. So why take Lola to his house? To kill her? Henry shrugged, placing the MPX in his lap. Probably. You don't seem too upset. What good would it do? So you really don't care about her anymore? I care about her enough to keep her alive for the sake of her son. But beyond that, no. The radio rattled on the dash, and Henry fished the mic from the floor. Static. Hey, did you assholes just turn and drive up the road? Wisely, he handed the mic to me. I took it and answered. We found the other ATF agent on scene. Static. Who was it? The little guy, Phil Vesco, Eddie the Viking's running buddy. Static. Him? I never would have figured it. I think that's what they count on. Anyway, tell Stainbrook he's walking down from the bunker, so don't shoot him. Nance took Lola up to his house, so we're on the way up there. Static, I want to go. No, he's up there alone. Stay with the plane, just in case he gets by us or isn't there. The only way out is that jet, so keep it bottled up. Static, you suck. Roger that. It only took a few minutes to get to Nance's house, and I was tempted to run into it. I thought the bear must have read. It is a nice house, and he is going to lose it by going to prison. So why not do the future owners a favor and spare it? Pulling in behind the Range Rover in the driveway, I bumped it and parked. Just a love tap. We climbed out and looked around, but didn't see anybody peeking from the windows or any rifle barrels, for that matter. How could they not hear us? The Cheyenne Nation ignored me and went for the door, which was unlocked. I watched as he used the barrel of the Sig Sauer to swing it open silently. Then he looked one way and the other. Clear. Following him in, I slid the 1911 from my holster and trained it on the balcony above, then dropped it back toward the entryway that led toward the kitchen. Indicating that Henry should go one way and I would go the other, I moved through the kitchen and trained the .45 in the great room where Nance and I had had our discussion just a few days before. The bear moved silently across that room toward the other end, which must have led to the garage, as I went the opposite way toward a split staircase in the living room. When I looked back, I could see Henry shaking his head no. I nodded and gestured for him to take the upstairs and began my descent. It was a wide stairway with custom-made treads that looked like ironwood. There was a security door at the bottom of a landing, heavy with small windows that I could tell were two-way mirrors. I stepped to the side and turned the gold handle, quietly pushing the door open and waiting a moment before stepping into the empty, carpeted hallway. There were photographs on the walls, lots of them, with Nance and celebrities on boats, in planes, and in race cars. I started down the hall, only to have Lola open the door on the end and move toward me with her head down, wearing nothing but a large white towel. I waited till she was easily in reach and then stepped forward, placing my hand over her mouth and gently pushing her to the wall and holding her there. Her eyes were wide as I held the barrel of the 45 to my lips to shush her. She tried to speak, but I held my hand firmly over her mouth. From this point on, you don't make a sound. You simply nod your head, yes? Or shake your head, no. Got it? She did. He in there? She nodded. Is he alone? She nodded again. Is he armed? She nodded once more. Does he know we're here? This time she shook her head. Good. I loosened my grip. Whisper. Where were you going? I could barely hear her when she finally spoke. Bathroom. Go there and lock the door behind you. Henry's here, too. I glanced at the towel. And he might just shoot you himself. I watched as she slid back to the wall and disappeared behind me, quietly closing and locking the door. I waited a moment and then turned back toward the end of the hallway. Another set of mirrors looked blankly at me, and I could only hope that Nance wasn't standing on the other side with one of his nifty little plastic guns pointed at me. Considering the thought, I stepped forward and pushed open one of the mirror doors. I moved to the side, slipped in, and stood there in the half-light. There was a series of weapon lockers to my left, and a gun safe beyond that, leading to a firing range about 25 yards in length, with a standard man-shaped silhouette target hanging from a motorized track at the far end. The walls and ceiling were covered in cone-shaped, noise-absorbing foam, and there was a shooter's station with a number of what I assumed were Nance's polymer pistols in different states of disassembly lying on the counter. There was a small observation area to the right behind a bulletproof glass wall and door, where a naked Bob Nance had his back to me and was evidently pouring himself a drink. You okay, baby? I waited a moment before answering. Yeah, I'm good. His head turned slightly, but his hands stayed where I couldn't see them, his voice slightly muffled by the heavy glass. Sheriff? Yep. I trained the barrel of my Colt on his midsection. You want to put those hands where I can see them? He didn't move. Would you like a drink? I want to see your hands. He lifted a tumbler holding a few cubes of ice and probably a healthy dollop of scotch up past his shoulder. Highland Park, 25-year-old. As I recall, you enjoyed it. The other hand. Come on, let's have a drink and discuss this like gentlemen. He turned a little, but still kept the other hand hidden. You've kind of caught me at an awkward time. I'm assuming you saw Lola? The hand, he sighed. Actually, I've got one of my guns. Would you like to see it? Yep, I would. He turned slowly, holding the tumbler in one hand and in the other one of the completely assembled polymer weapons. But this was a strange one, a blocky Desert Tan revolver which he had pointed toward the ceiling. Are you sure you won't have a drink? Put the weapon on the counter. He didn't move the gun hand, but did bring the glass up and sip his scotch. Do you have any idea how much this thing cost? In lives? He smiled. In dollars. I don't care. It's a prototype. I wanted to see just how much power the new stuff could handle. So we made this all-polymer revolver in a .454 Casull model. The line of thought being that if the new plastic could hold up to this round, it could hold up to anything. Put it on the counter. You know one of the great things about the .454? It can deliver a 250-grain bullet with a muzzle velocity of over 1,900 feet per second and about 2,000 foot-pounds of energy, meaning it'll shoot through bulletproof glass like this one between us like a hot knife through butter. He sipped his scotch some more and lowered the barrel of the revolver on me. And you know what the worst caliber to shoot through bulletproof glass is? He continued to point the revolver at me. That 45 ACP you're carrying, it'll make a dent, but it won't go through. Muzzle velocity is just too slow. He gestured with the plastic gun. Not like this. I glanced at the closed glass door to my right. Don't do it. I'll shoot you before you make it. I sighed. Then what? What do you mean? I've got backup. He smiled some more, and I really wanted to shoot at him. Bulletproof glass be damned. So do I. No, you don't. They're all running for the hills. He looked a little unsure now. We've grounded your plane, and I ran over two of your trucks and crashed into your bunker with that MRAP you bought the police department. His eyes widened a little. I guess you're not enjoying the irony in that, huh? I pulled out my pocket watch and looked at it. And in less than an hour, every cop in Wyoming is going to be all over this place, not to mention the federal government, and a really pissed-off Indian who is roaming your house with some kind of 9mm machine pistol, which probably won't go through this glass either, but you're going to have to come out of that fishbowl sometime, Lance. I glanced around at the acoustical foam walls of the million-dollar basement. Even when you talked, you could hear your voice sticking there, which made the delivery of the next words that much more enjoyable. And when you do, nobody's going to hear you die. Epilogue. I sipped my beer at the Ponderosa Cafe and watched Henry and Vic talking with another long-haired individual I didn't know. This guy looked a little different from the rest in that he was carrying a guitar case. Things had settled back down into a regular August High Plains summer day. The streets were pretty much cleared of tourist biker traffic. The vendors were striking their tents, and the whole town of Hewlett had that after-the-carnival feel to it, as if the world had packed up and left the place behind. Melancholy. Or maybe it was just me. I'd wanted to head home, but Stainbrook and the feds had asked us to stick around for the depositions that would assure Nance spent the rest of his life in rooms without light switches. Heck, I would have stayed in hell for that. Truth to be told, Hewlett was a beautiful little town when not in biker season, and I was attempting to enjoy the downtime, aside from being on the phone in negotiation with the greatest legal mind of our time about moving sofas and helping to paint ceilings. You're tall and you don't have to use a ladder. I could bring Henry. He doesn't have to use a ladder, and he actually knows how to paint. Wonder if you can sleep on the new sofa after you go pick it up. Right. I held Bodaway's phone against my ear and reached over and petted Dog. I've got a weapons recertification in Douglas and a parole hearing to sit through down there in Cheyenne, so we'll be heading that way soon. That Western Star thing? Yep. Oh, Daddy, isn't it time to let that go? Ed was silent on the line for a few moments. So have you seen Lola? Other than when we pass her on our way in to make our statements to the feds, no. Do you suppose she's in Rapid City at the hospital? It's where I'd be. It's where you've been. There was another pause. So everybody goes to jail? Prison, I sighed, wishing I were in another line of work so that my daughter and I would have nicer things to chat about on the phone. Nance is lawyered up, but he's never going to see the light of day. And they picked up his daughter in Rapid City for tax evasion, but it's looking more and more like she didn't have anything to do with all this. She and Bodaway were just in love. Go figure. What about Billy V. Kiddo? Conspiracy and a number of other charges, but he's singing like Janis Joplin, and he'll probably get away with suspended sentences and have another outlaw pelt for his resume. By the time he's done spinning it, he'll probably have saved all of the ATF and us single-handedly. There were some producers here already, looking to develop a new reality show with the Inked Idiot. You're kidding. I wish I were. What about the Nazi thing? Not for public consumption and probably not good for ratings. Part of the deal he made with the ATF. Besides, it would all be inadmissible. I'm not worried about it, though. His type always ends up getting what they deserve eventually. Who killed the ATF agent Post? I sighed and continued on, figuring lawyering wasn't that much more pleasant than sheriffing after all. Nance. They found Kiddo's pistol in Bob's collection in his private little shooting gallery downstairs, along with a bunch of others, like trophies. Blowback on the barrels and still carrying his fingerprints. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't connect him to a whole slew of other homicides before it was all over.
But it is all over.
Yep.
So when are you heading home?
Henry and Vic just got back from returning her rental car in Rapid City. They seem to be talking to a couple of guys from the garage band that's been playing here all week. We still have to hook up the motorcycle trailer, but then we'll be heading home.
Be careful.
And don't get any more guns pointed at you, okay? Sure thing, punk.
I love you.
Love you, too. I pressed the button and disconnected. Whatever happened to hanging up the phone? And placed the mobile on the table as the two came ambling over. I noticed Vic holding a CD still in the cellophane. I can't believe that guy talked you into buying his music. I glanced past them and could see roadies still packing up the band's equipment. I hope you told them to broaden their musical horizons. You can't get far enough just doing covers of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Henry nodded. Unless you are Lynyrd Skynyrd. What? Vic held out the best of CD. They are Lynyrd Skynyrd. She glanced behind, but the band members were gone.
At least they were.
I finished my beer, smiled, and quickly backtracked. I thought they sounded awfully good for a garage band. The Cheyenne Nation decided that in celebration of winning the Jackpine Gypsy's Hill Climb, he would ride Lucy home with his trophy tied to the headlight a la Marlon Brando in The Wild One. We were to follow in the T-Bird with Rosalie and Bodoway's Harley in tow on the trailer. We watched as he checked the tie-down straps on them and then put on a pair of goggles and a Bell Boss helmet and straddled the four-cylinder Indian. Are you sure you want to ride that thing all the way back to Absaroka County?
That is what it is for.
I glanced at Vic and gestured toward the sidecar. Would you like to join him? She walked back and cracked the door of the Baltic Blue convertible and ushered Dog into the back before flipping the seat and climbing in.
Thanks, but no thanks.
The bear shrugged, kicked the vintage Indian to life, and throttled away as I walked back and climbed in the Thunderbird, pulling out from the Hewlett Motel and circling the parking lot in a wide arc after him. It was late in the afternoon, and the sun had already reached its zenith, slanting its rays in a golden horizontal that highlighted the landscape to its fullest effect. We rolled out of town, following the Indian on the Indian, and I couldn't help but feel a certain anticipation for the geologic wonder just ahead.
What the hell is that?
Bad God Tower must have had a peek at her as we topped one of the tiny hillocks and drifted south. I didn't say anything but just eased the big Thunderbird through the curves until we topped the last hill and swept down an easy slope on Route 24 that opened into the wide straightaway where Henry and I had stopped on the way into town.
Holy shit!
It was the effect that Devil's Tower had on folks the first time they actually saw it. Photographs don't really prepare you for just how impressive the first United States monument is. I slowed the convertible, allowing Vic the full impact of the Mato Tipula, as the Cheyenne referred to it. It's something, huh? As we drifted slowly along, I saw that the Cheyenne Nation had pulled onto the turnoff to Devil's Tower, possibly to idle a little in the majesty of the natural wonder. I then saw that it was an unnatural wonder that had caught his attention. Slowing down still more, I stopped the convertible alongside the road at a little distance, allowing them some privacy. Vic was paying no attention, her focus still on the tower as she unbuckled and kneeled in the passenger seat, her hands on the door sill, to study the geologic wonder.
Wow!
Even Dog moved over to the right side of the back seat for a gander, but my attention was drawn ahead, where a red 1948 Indian sat in a wide pullover parked opposite a gold 66 Cadillac.
Can we go see it?
My attention was drawn back to Vic. Probably not now.
Come on.
She turned in the seat toward me, but stopped when she saw the tableau up ahead.
Uh-oh.
The bear was still seated on the motorcycle now, with his helmet off. But Lola Wojciechowski had pushed off the grill of the caddy and was standing in a provocative manner with hands on swiveling hips.
Boy, I wish I was a fly in a sidecar right now.
Not me.
Vic turned and slid back in her seat, and Dog, recognizing the emotionally charged situation even from afar, registered a low whine. My undersheriff reached back and ran her hand across his muzzle.
Easy, boy.
Were you talking to him or me?
Both.
We sat there in the silence with a light breeze drifting from Devil's Tower, the smell of the juniper and jack pines better than incense.
I wonder what they're talking about.
I think it's more of a who. Lola moved closer, even going so far as to drape a wrist over the handlebars of the big Indian motorcycle. Henry didn't move, and she upped the ante by arching her back, her black leather jacket and cropped white T-shirt riding up, displaying the ring in her belly button.
Boy, she's playing it for all it's worth, huh?
Maybe. But I don't think he's in the game.
There was a little more conversation, but you could tell that Lola wasn't getting what she wanted. After a few more exchanges, the bear placed his helmet back on his head, pulled the goggles down, and slipped on his gloves. He cocked his head at something she said, and then stood, kicking the Indian to life. He gave her a jaunty salute as she hugged herself with one arm, and then he throttled up and pulled out. I fired up the Thunderbird and slipped it in gear, easing the convertible and trailer onto the state route. As we approached Lola, she stepped onto the road and held up a hand like a traffic cop.
"Just keep going."
As much as I wanted to heed Vic's advice, the gentleman in me slowed and stopped as the dark-haired woman with a silver shot through it rounded the front of the T-Bird, laid an arm across the top of the windshield, and smiled down exclusively at me.
"Hi."
"Hello, Lola." She finally glanced at Vic, extending the other hand across me and bringing the scent of perfume, leather, and utter abandonment into my nostrils as they politely shook.
"Lola Wasikowski."
Vic batted her eyelashes, and her tone was buttery strychnine.
"I've heard so much about you."
She glanced back and then cracked open the passenger side door, stepping out and allowing Dog to follow.
"We're taking a short walk."
She glanced at me. "A short walk, and then we'll be right back." My undersheriff and my dog strolled into the high grass, both of them gazing at the monolith in the distance.
"Kind of got you on a short leash, doesn't she?"
Tipping my hat to provide a little personal shade, I glanced up at her. "What do you want, Lola? I've got to catch up with Henry." She grinned the killer smile and studied me.
"I just wanted to say thanks."
"For what?"
"For everything.
You were very nice to me, and I don't get that a lot." I didn't say anything.
"See? Still nice."
Her eyes played over to Devil's Tower, and I was beginning to lose my patience.
"You probably think I need to be in jail, huh?"
"Not my problem." She studied the landscape some more and then nodded.
"I play the percentages, Sheriff. It's how I survive."
"And what were the percentages on having sex with Brady Post just before he died?" Her turn to say nothing, but she did swivel her head back to study me. "I'm fighting the thought that Nance put you up to it so that he could kill Post post-coitus. What's it like to have sex with a man knowing he's going to die?" She smiled and shook her head in a dismissive fashion, the silver streak falling over her forehead like a lightning bolt as her scary green eyes focused on me through the tangle of lush hair.
"You're all dying, whether I decide to screw you or not."
I hit the starter on the Thunderbird and, ready to go, leaned back in my seat. She grinned the wicked grin again and cocked her head, giving the impression that she was willing to hop in and give me one of her free samples, samples being all that Lola ever gave for free.
"I'm not sure why it is that I'm thanking you, though."
Her expression became a little graver.
"You never did find out who ran my son off the road."
Hearing the motor on the Big Bird idling, Vic returned with Dog and let him climb in the back before taking her seat and closing the door after her. I shrugged. "I would have thought it was an obvious fact, Lola. You did." Delivering a pitch-perfect performance, she laughed and shook her head.
"You're crazy."
I pulled the young man's phone from my pocket and handed it to her. "Either because he had Chloe Nance on the back of the bike, or because you wanted him out of Bob Nance's gun business, you and that Cadillac of yours were what sent Boataway off the road that night. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and think you didn't know about the culvert that did the majority of the damage. But those are the facts, for what it's worth." Her expression remained the same as she palmed her son's phone, staring at it. "Now, if you don't mind, and even if you do, we'd like to go home." She smirked a little and still held on to her vehicular namesake as if it were a life preserver.
"If you believed that, Sheriff, you'd have me in jail."
I took a deep breath in an attempt not to be cruel, but some situations are deserving of it, and some people too.
Not really. Because when I think about your son lying down there in the Rapid City Regional ICU, I figure there's nothing that the ATF, I, or the law could do to you that could possibly compare to the punishment you've constructed for yourself. I slipped the lever into gear, but she still didn't move, maybe because she couldn't. Goodbye, Lola. She had no resort but to let the shiny chrome molding of the windshield slip from her grasp as we pulled away. And I wasn't tempted to look into the rearview mirror. Not even once.
The End. This is George Guidel. We hope you've enjoyed this production of An Obvious Fact by Craig Johnson. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.